CDC podcast taken from our Insight event series. The series aims to share practical lessons on private sector investment and development based on our experiences, knowledge, and research. In this episode, we hear environmentalist, author, and serial entrepreneur John Elkington in conversation with CDC's CEO, Nick O'Donoghue. They're joined by CDC's Climate Change Director, Amal Lee Amin, to discuss how we move forward in a way which creates a more balanced and sustainable global economy.
Good afternoon, everybody. My name is Nick O'Donoghue. I'm the Chief Executive Officer of CDC. And it's my great pleasure to welcome you today to the latest in our Insight series. And it's also my pleasure to welcome somebody that I have known and admired for a long time, and that is John Elkington. John is the founder of Volance. And you know, at a time when we all live in a world where questions of sustainability and actions on climate change and corporate responsibility are sort of front and center across the dialogue around the world and among governments and the private sector, it's fair to say that long before this subject became topical, there was John. And John was talking about them probably 40 years ago. His book, Green Swans, is described as a draft manifesto for capitalism, democracy, and sustainability. So that's a big, big subject. It's hugely topical. And there's really nobody better qualified to talk about it today than John. So it's a great pleasure and great privilege for me to introduce John Elkington.
Thank you, Nick. And hello, everyone. I don't need to sort of underscore the impact of the pandemic of COVID-19, but it is an extraordinary time. I actually happen to think that it could actually benefit us, not just simply destroy in a way. And one of the things I've been trying to say to companies, which is largely where we focus our efforts since the Sustainable Development Goals came out in 2015, is that they are not simply incremental goals. They are system change goals. And you can view them as exponential goals as well. If you just take the first two, no poverty and zero hunger by 2030, that's a super exponential pair of goals. Yet most people in business and in the financial markets are not yet seeing them in quite that way. And part of the reason is that our brains really were not configured to think exponentially or to act exponentially. And yet that is where we now are, and that's what we now need to learn how to do. So where in all of that do swans of various colors fit in? So pretty much everyone listening in will have heard of Nassim Nicholas Taleb, and I suspect most of you will have read at least part of his book, The Black Swan, which came out in 2007, just before the financial crash. And people have been asking him left, right, and center recently, is COVID-19 a black swan? In fact, they've been assuming that it is. And his answer is, no, it's not. Because a proper black swan is an outlier in the sense that it's a complete surprise. It has an extreme off-the-scale impact. And unfortunately, after it's crashed through, we look back at what's just happened to us, and we don't properly understand why whatever happened did happen, and therefore we set ourselves up for failure again. So black swans, we understand a bit better. What about green swans? Well, green swans for me are trajectories, trends, initiatives, developments, which instead of black swans, which take us exponentially very often where we don't want to go, green swans at least potentially take us exponentially where we do want to go. So I'm not going to read out the definitions, but simply to say these are not individual companies. These are not individual leaders, although leaders and companies may well have green swan characteristics or development banks or whatever else. But for me, they're market shifts and they're profound market shifts.
Thank you, John. So I suppose the question is whether or not this systemic change can really happen without some form of incentives. And people talk about the importance, for example, of carbon taxes. People talk more recently about the need for more impact-weighted accounts. So I suppose the question is really, can this work without a significant change in the way we look at companies, measure companies' performance, and incentivize chief executives?
Well, the simple answer, Nick, and you know it, is no. We need incentives, but incentives can be painful and they can be pleasurable. They can be negative, they can be positive. And I think I did a chaired a session in the City of London a couple of weeks back, and the head of Federated Hermes was there. And one of the things he was saying was, here we suddenly are in a transformed reality, and things that were considered completely impossible have suddenly been done by companies, by, to some degree, financial markets, but particularly by governments. So the incentives are coming at us. And at the moment, it's a pandemic, and there will be more of those. Behind that is the climate emergency. And behind that, you've got the biodiversity problems and a range of other issues as well. But I think we're at actually a very interesting inflection point. And I think the New York Times last week published a piece on Milton Friedman's 50-year-old now statement of what the purpose of business was. And I think Friedman is a very brilliant man, but he's dictated the terms of economic discourse for a very long period of time. And in one way or another, reality is showing that Friedmanism takes you so far, but it really doesn't set you up for success in the sort of realities that we're now moving into.
What do you think the role for government is in ensuring this transition takes place?
I don't think there's any way in which business and financial markets, even if working in concert, can do all of this on their own. Governments absolutely have to play a role, but it has to be an effective one. And so government has to be, as far as possible, clean. So the bribery and corruption sort of agenda is even more important in the era that we're going into than it was previously. It's got to have sound targeting and a way of monitoring progress against those sort of goals and targets. But critically, and this is your earlier point, there have got to be incentives. We cannot simply rely on people to do this because this is the right thing for their children or their grandchildren or, you know, billions of people elsewhere in the world. They've got to be incentivized. And that's particularly true if you're dealing with economies and capitalism and business and so on. Now, those incentives, once again, can be tax breaks and things like that, but they can also be penalties. I mean, where industries like the fossil fuels industry, which are demonstrably undermining the health of our climate, need to be taxed over time out of existence. So your point about carbon tax, absolutely fundamentally important.
The other issue that's also pertinent to incentives is the question of, and I know you've done this, have enormous experience in working with so many large and smaller companies around the world. But it's a question of how you change the culture of a company. And, yeah. You know, Paul Polman wrote the sort of prologue introduction to your book. He's an inspiring leader that clearly changed the culture of a large company. But that's a difficult thing to do. And what often seems to happen is that people get to chief executive, then they start talking about sustainability and they start talking about corporate responsibility. But underneath it, you've got all the other people all trying to become the chief executive who still stay focused on the sort of bread and butter business of sort of maximizing returns. So based on your experience, what do you tell companies and what do you tell chief executives and boards about how culture can change?
That as an incoming CEO, you've probably got about a year and a half in which you can make a big change. And after that, you're just overwhelmed by events. And you mentioned Paul Polman, and one of the most memorable things Paul did was right at the beginning of his tenure was to say to the hedge funds, if you want to know what I'm going to deliver in terms of financial performance a quarter or three quarters ahead, I don't want your money. No CEO, to my knowledge, had previously done that. Now, Paul himself said if it had been 3 years in, he couldn't have done that. But just his board probably didn't want to sack him as soon as he arrived. So I think there's a personal courage element of this. There's a timing element of this. I also think one of the things that business leaders have woken up to is elements of what they're being asked to do now are already happening elsewhere. And so one of the things that can be useful is to selectively pick out competitors, customer industries, whatever, that are already modeling some of the new mindsets and behaviors and so on, and go and see them.
So let's, before we bring in Amélie, let's just, as a final question, talk about the role of investment. And I'm particularly interested in two different classes of investors. One is the impact investment community, which has obviously grown up substantially in the last decade or so. And how important a movement is that, and what role do you think that plays in this change? And also, obviously, specifically within that, I suppose, broad community of impact investment firms, the development finance community, and organizations like CDC, what roles you think we can and should be playing?
Right. Now, I think impact investment is immensely exciting. I think the way in which we've gone from a world where we only thought, I used to do environmental impact assessment in emerging and developing countries and so on, and we were almost exclusively looking for problems, the negative footprints. Now we're thinking much more constructively about the positive impacts, and we're thinking about how we measure positive impact and how we value it and how we reward and incentivize people for all of that good stuff. Now, I'm immensely excited about that. I chair an advisory board within Novartis where we're trying to put financial valuations on social and environmental progress. But I think the impact investment, it's grown spectacular, as you said, but $500 billion, that's a rounding error, not quite, but it's still very, very small proportion of the trillions of euros or dollars that sluice through the global economy routinely. But I don't think we should overestimate the short, by which I mean 5 to 10 year impact of some of that stuff. But I think it will be over time decisive. Then to the development banks, I think they're absolutely foundational. I think they're absolutely critical. I think, you know, in many ways, the whole sort of Bretton Woods structure was built up around the development bank principle. And many of the early impact mindsets and methodologies were pioneered there. The one thing I would love to see, though, is that at the moment it strikes me very often that individual development banks and international development institutions are doing their own things so often. And I don't want a Vatican, I don't want everyone to suddenly sort of come under one roof, but I do wish we had more coordinated efforts. And just finally, the four big accounting companies just having announced within the last week and a half that they were going to come together and produce a single standard for sustainability reporting. On the one hand, I'm immensely excited about that. On the other hand, having seen Ernst & Young, just to name one, and Wirecard, you just wonder, are we replacing one problem with another? But we do need integrated standards, and I think the development banks have a crucial role to play in that, not just in mobilizing capital.
Great. Thanks, John. So at this point, I'm going to bring in Amalie. Amalie Amin is the head of climate strategy at CDC. She worked for a long time in a climate role at the UK government and with the IBD in Washington. So we're enormously pleased to have Amalie at CDC. And I'm going to ask her to talk, maybe share her reflections, not just on what she's seen in CDC in the last 6 months or so, but what progress she's seen over the last 10 years. And then specifically talk maybe a little bit, Amalie, about CDC, what we're doing and how we're laying out our climate strategy. And then after, then I'll come back and we'll have a conversation between Amalie and John. So Amalie.
Thank you. And it's a great honor and privilege to be with both of you in terms of, you know, leading this agenda of sustainability and impact. You know, I think in the midst of the COVID, early stages of COVID, I read a review of Green Swans, and I must say it heartened me a lot in terms of the whole thesis that you put forward, John, that we can, and, you know, if we have the political will and leadership, that now really in this coming decade is the time for regeneration. And to a large extent, I think, you know, most of my career and certainly my academic background, I did my PhD at SPRU. And, you know, so reading, in fact, what was then a review of your book, it made me feel like maybe what was happening now with COVID was the big sort of disjuncture that we needed to actually be able to really, as many say now, build back better. You know, the crisis that, where the global economy comes to a stop, as it did, provides an opportunity to actually, you know, build back in a way that is consistent with sustainable development, including tackling climate change and obviously the breakdown in biodiversity. And in fact, a large part of my work at the IDB was very much, as you just said, John, trying to improve how the MDBs in particular collaborate more effectively. And I increasingly, and I think, again, this is sort of a reflection on what I've seen over the last 20 years, in fact, working in this area, is that there's been, and myself included, a huge focus on the international architecture for very, very good reasons. But increasingly, what I've started to see is it really doesn't matter what happens at the international architecture level in terms of how development banks collaborate if it's not working at the country level, if you're not bringing together different resources, expertise, areas of comparative advantage, different forms of finance, public finance, of course, you know, the kind of capital that CDC brings, the expertise that we can bring, you know, all of these things have to come together at the country level. And that's what I would say over the last 10, 20 years, I've increasingly come to that conclusion. I would say that I do believe that the Paris Agreement was an incredible achievement. It was much more ambitious than anyone anticipated it would be. It also places at its heart sustainable development and also this issue of economic transformation and transition. And I think that, along with the SDGs, all reinforces the points your book makes very eloquently, John, around this next decade being really the critical time and hopefully one of exponential change.
Thanks, Emily. John, I want to come back. I mean, Emily touched on the sort of the great issue of the day, which is COVID, and potentially the opportunity that gives us to have a sort of a reset and build back better. I mean, there's also the school of thought that says, actually, a crisis of this magnitude, an economic crisis, as well as obviously a health crisis of this magnitude, could actually derail the powerful momentum that was building up behind the need to address the climate emergency. So I wonder how you feel about that.
Well, on bad days, I'm a pessimist, and I think the whole world is going to hell in a handbasket or a handcart or whatever it is meant to go to hell in. But on good days, and I was born an optimist, you have to be if you're going to be in a field like this one, we are moving into a much more challenging and a much more potentially dangerous period of our collective history. Our global governance systems that were constructed largely after the Second World War are no longer fit for purpose. And they're beginning to fail. And my own sense, and in the book, the first diagram is a U-bend, and it goes back to what just Emily was saying, which is, I think there are long wave economic cycles in our economies. I think we are now into the downward part of the latest down wave. And these things do not recover overnight. You don't get a V-shaped or a U-shaped or a W-shaped recovery. These are things that will take 12 to 15 years if we're lucky, and a generation or two if we're not, to really crank through. So to your question, is this a bad thing? It depends. It depends what we choose to make of it. And if we choose to react in the right way, I think it could be a fantastic opportunity. Terrible thing to say with a million people already dead and a lot more likely to die. But we needed a shock like this. And the question is now, what do we do with it?
Thank you. So we've got just 1 minute left. So let me just quickly ask both of you, you know, if there was one thing, one call for action, one message you'd like to give to sort of corporate chief executives today, what would that message be? Amelie, do you want to go first?
I think be determined to make the changes that are needed. I mean, show that real genuine leadership. And, you know, I think what's interesting, we saw again New York Climate Week last week, there's now over 1,500 companies that have made a commitment to be net zero. And, you know, and this is phenomenal. And this is trillions of dollars of value. So showing that leadership is, it's a leadership role within a community of leaders on this agenda. And I think, you know, recognizing though that that commitment is excellent, but it's the actions to deliver on that that are now needed over the coming decade.
Thanks. John, last word to you.
Get out more. When the roof is coming around your head, the temptation is to stay chained to your desk and sort of do whatever you can. The future is out there. The future is incredibly exciting. It's going to be quite challenging too, but by God, it's exciting. Go out and see some of the people who are helping to create it and see what you can do to play into that. So yeah, get out more.
Great. So thank you. Look, our time is up. So I wanted to thank both our panelists, thank Emily, obviously from CDC, and especially John Elkington. And the book is called Green Swans, and I would recommend it to everybody. That was a fascinating discussion. I mean, we're facing a challenge of enormous magnitude, but I think it's certainly great to know John, there are people like you willing to stand up and take a leadership position as you've done for decades now. And so we thank you for that. And we thank you particularly for spending the time with us today.
Thanks.
And thanks everybody for listening. Bye-bye.
Thank you for listening to this CDC podcast. You can find all our podcasts and more details of our Insight series on our website, cdcgroup.com.